Hey, how are you today, neighbors? This is Terry Martin, host of Talk Around Town here at WRFR FM 93.3 in Rockland. And of course, you folks in Camden know how you can get a hold of us. But more importantly, I want you to be aware of the fact that WRFR is streaming online. Now, apparently some people can't get it. It depends on what your audio setup is, I suppose. But try it out. It's WRFR.org. So if you run out of the radio show, you can always pick it up on your computer. And I want to give you my studio telephone number. The calls will come right in here to the studio. It's 593-0013. And we've got a couple guests today that are going to knock your socks off, especially if you're into politics and what's going on in the world today, which if you've been listening to the show, you know I kind of tend toward what's happening out there so that we can take whatever steps we can as little people to try to make changes. But first, I want to acknowledge my sponsor, Sweets and Meats, the eclectic market at the south end of town, all kinds of super good goodies at reasonable prices, nice place to eat. They've got a lot of imported stuff, but it's priced right. Good wines, imported wines, beers, the whole nine yards. So Sweets and Meats, 218 Main Street, the south end of town, right across from the harbor. Check them out. Okay, today I've got two guys that have more experience with world politics, and in particular the Middle East, than any two people I know. And we're going to have a rousing discussion today, because the issue is going to be Israel versus, I suppose, or slash, depending on your perspective, the Palestinian issue. These two men have spent virtually their lives in the Middle East, working with the parties on all sides, know the characters, know the politics, and somewhere along the line today, I'm going to put it to them and ask them, with all their experience and what they know, do they see any light at the end of the tunnel? And if so, what might it be? But before we get to that, I want you to know a little bit about these fellas, because they're incredibly familiar with what's going on. Let me start with you first, Norman. Norman Olson. Okay, Norman lives right here in Maine, Cherryfield, I believe. And Norman's been with the State Department, I believe, for a bunch of years. He was with the U.S. Embassy in Israel, which tells you that he's not doing this by TV. He was there. He met with the people. He listened to the conversations. He talked to the people on the ground. So he has a real good feel about that. And he'll be bringing to the table all those things that he learned while in the U.S. Embassy in Israel. He was responsible for assistance to Gaza. Aha, you know that name and what's going on over there. And monitoring Israeli-Palestinian relations, such as they were and such as they are. And of course, you all know what's going on over there. The peace talks have been put together by Obama. He says that it's time, that it's in everybody's interest, including the United States, to come up with some resolutions. And it'll be interesting to see what our guests have to say about whether or not they think a resolution is possible and under what circumstances. My second guest is named Walter Rogers. And Walter, again, has tremendous experience in the Middle East, and he was the former senior international correspondent for CNN. So we've got some real heavyweights here. So if you want to call them and ask them any questions about what's going on over there and what about this or what about that, you know how to do it. 594-0013. My producers tell me it's 593. What did I say? No, I'm sorry if I confused you. It's 593-0013. And these gentlemen will answer any questions that you have. I've talked to them briefly before the show. And let me tell you something. These guys are loaded. They know their stuff. They're not afraid to speak out about what the issues are. And they're both very, very heavily involved in world affairs today. Walter, for example, writes, I think, a biweekly column in which he goes into all of these things. And Norman is writing, in the process of writing a book, I believe, if you haven't already written a couple. I mean, these guys are heavy hitters, like I said. Let me talk to you first, Norman. If you would, please. Give me a little bit about your background so the folks out there, I mean, I touched on it briefly, but so the folks out there know that you're a man who knows what he's talking about.
Well, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm honored to be on the show, but I want to point out that I'm particularly honored to be here with Walter Rogers, whose work I've admired on the first ABC and then CNN for years, both when I was in the Middle East and when I was outside the Middle East trying to keep track of what was going on. And that's where I could go to at the time to count on reporting from Walter and his colleague at the time, Gerald Kessel, who provided extraordinary reporting out of Jerusalem and the occupied territories. I'm originally from Maine, joined the Foreign Service in 1983, and it was an indirect course to the Middle East where I landed in 1991. I had no background in the Middle East and no intention of going there, but I had the opportunity to go there for a peculiar job monitoring USAID projects in the Gaza Strip, which was then totally occupied by Israel and had Israeli settlements. And I took the job because it sounded fascinating. So I spent 4 years working in the Gaza Strip, then left, went on to other assignments, and returned in 2002 as chief of the political section, a job they call counselor for political affairs at U.S. Embassy Tel Aviv. And I was responsible for a whole range of issues concerning the Israel, the occupied territories, Palestinian affairs, internal Israeli affairs, and such issues as human rights, trafficking in persons, political military affairs, and all the other issues in the political relationship with the Palestinians.
I want to just pick up on one thing you said, because I think the listeners out there would find that interesting. A guy like you coming right from our local hometown. You come from a commercial fisherman family, and in fact, I think you did it for a while, did you not?
That's right. All of my family members, other than me, are commercial fishermen or involved in the commercial fishing industry. I started lobstering in Cape Elizabeth when I was 12, had my own skiff, and by the time I got done 2 years out of college, I was had a 32-foot Jonesport boat and 550 traps. And from there, I was involved in regional fisheries management. I did a brief stint on the Portland Press Herald as a newspaper reporter and then got back in the fishing industry. I was an appointed member of the New England Regional Fishery Management Council from 1978 to 81. And in fact, I served at the same time as Frank O'Hara, the proprietor of O'Hara Fisheries down here, a boat owner and a prominent member of your community. We're longstanding friends, and I hope to catch up with him soon.
Well, thank you, sir. It's nice to know that the local folks can and do well, let me switch over now to Walter Rogers. Walter, thanks for coming. We appreciate it greatly.
Thanks, Terry.
If you don't mind, Walter, so that there's some young people out there who really don't know how all of this evolved to where, you know, they read the paper and watch the TV now and they know what the situation is. But can you just take us back in time and tell us how this all started? I suppose it was 1940-something.
No, actually, it was about 4,000 years ago when a fellow named Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. And Jacob stole Esau's birthright. Esau wanted to kill his brother Jacob. And they've been fighting over the birthright ever since. It's about land, and it goes back that far.
Now, there's also religion heavily involved here, is it not?
Yes. Who are the true inheritors of Abraham? Abraham, if you know your Hebrew Bible.
Well, Abraham was the grandfather to us all, as I recall.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm English and German, so I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
But and Welsh. Don't forget the Welsh.
Okay.
Abraham is, and you really need to read your Bibles, read your Torah, the Hebrew Bible, to find out what this is about. And they're still fighting. I mean, you know, I've been in Damascus talking to Syrian scholars, and they say, oh, no. When Moses fled Egypt on the Exodus, he went to Saudi Arabia. He didn't go up through the east. And they claim that the name of the mountain, where Mount Sinai, is not the true site of the biblical Ten Commandments. It was actually the Saudis have got it, and the Arabs, the Muslims, still argue that the entire birthright was stolen and the Jews cheated them out of it. So forget 1945. We're talking 4,000 years of arguing over who is the proper inheritor of Abraham's birthright and who are the proper custodians of the land.
Okay. Would you bring us up, however, to the point in time, and Norman, feel free to jump in, when the state of Israel, not as it is now, because it was a little different then, but when it was formed, why was it formed, who is it formed by, all those things that a lot of folks out there don't know about.
Actually, Norman's the better person to take this.
Okay, Norm.
Take it away, Norm.
Thanks very much. I'll try to keep this brief. In the late 19th century, a movement began among European Jews who were settled throughout all of Eastern and Western Europe, Russia, the Mediterranean region, to have a homeland of their own. And the movement came as a result of persecution by the host countries in which they lived. That included Poland and Russia in particular, where they were subject to a lot of persecution. And there was a movement afoot to find a homeland. And that movement developed over the course of about 40 or 50 years to settle on the homeland being their traditional homeland in the Eastern Mediterranean, what at the time was known as Palestine, in which was ruled by the Ottoman Empire, the Turks out of Istanbul, what is now Istanbul, and earlier history had been Constantinople. But at the time, the Ottomans, of course, were autocratic rulers. They controlled all of the eastern Mediterranean, much of Asia Minor, and almost all of North Africa in one form or another. When this movement began, they looked at various areas to go, and it's kind of funny. The areas they looked at, the Zionist movement, included Patagonia in southern Argentina, Uganda in Africa. There was even a look, I learned recently, at Isle Royale, which is a big island on the U.S.-Canada border on the road where you take up to Ottawa. And there's the idea that this island could become the Jewish national homeland. But the powers that be pointed toward what was known at the time as Palestine. Palestine was inhabited by a primarily Arab population, Muslim and Christian, both Arabs, and a lot of other races, Armenians and others. But the Zionist movement established the first modern Jewish city in Israel in the 1870s and began immigration there, buying property, setting up what became small cities and kibbutzes, and pressuring European governments and the Ottoman Empire to support the development of a Jewish homeland there. When World War I broke out, I'll try to contain this, when World War I broke out, the Ottomans sided with the Germans, and the Zionist lobby, that is the lobby of European and American Jewry that wanted this homeland, began strongly pushing the British government as lead of the Allies to create a homeland for Jews in Palestine when they won the war. And as a result, the British government, after years of this pressure, issued what was called the Balfour Declaration, which expressed the sentiment of the British government the positive sentiment to create this homeland, subject to provisions that would prevent any harm, damage, or a negative impact on the indigenous inhabitants, meaning
who were
the Arabs, Christian, Muslim, Armenians, Egyptians, people of all races there.
Was there any one individual in this country that took up the cudgel to support this?
The movement was primarily in Britain and led by the Rothschild family, among others. But Theodor Herzl was an early proponent of that in Britain, along with last name was Samuel. Who was a member of Parliament in Britain, Herbert Samuel, who was a member of Parliament who strongly pressed the British government for this. It was a British government action. What's interesting is that this is long before there was a Holocaust, long before there was Hitler, and it was an action taken by the British government when they had not yet won the war. The Ottomans and the Germans were not defeated at that point. Throughout the 20s and 30s, Britain along with France ruled the entire Middle East, and that what became the countries of Egypt, Syria, Transjordan, as it was originally called, Lebanon, and Palestine. And the Zionist movement pressed the Brits to lead Palestine toward becoming a Jewish homeland. The problem was, of course, that the majority people there did not see it as becoming a Jewish homeland. And regrettably, all during that period, Palestinians were the only people, the only region, Palestine, that was denied the opportunity for a plebiscite of self-determination. Lebanon, Transjordan, Syria, and Egypt were all allowed plebiscites and all became independent before World War II, right at the very end of World War II. World War II, so there were hostilities back and forth between Jews and Arabs and other peoples in the Middle East, much of it initiated by Arabs who did not want to see themselves, their property, the real estate we're talking, and their rights subject to a Jewish state, which would, of course, by its nature be a Jewish religious state because Judaism is a religion. And it has different tenets than Christianity and different tenets than Islam. Cutting to the action, after the war, violence broke out. The British, who had been operating under a League of Nations mandate to govern Palestine, decided they couldn't do anything. There's an excellent book on this topic called Mandate Days by a fellow named Sherman. They walked away, just turned the whole thing over to the United Nations. The United Nations, which at that time was comprised of only something like 68 countries, none of which, except for South Africa and Egypt, were in Africa because all of Africa was colonies. The United Nations decided to partition Palestine, and regrettably, under various pressures, they determined that the 33% of the population that was Jewish and which owned 6% of the land, that 6%, would get 55% of the country, and that the peoples, regardless of race or ethnicity in that 55%, would become subjects of a Jewish state. The Palestinians rebelled, and there was additional armed conflict initiated, in fact, by the Arabs and by the neighboring Arab states. And war ensued. The Israelis won, drove the Palestinians back into what became Gaza and the West Bank, and the situation is today as a result of that.
And the shorthand is the British screwed up the world.
Yeah.
It was a British mandate in Palestine, and if you look at how the British ran the crumbling post-colonial world, the trouble with India and Pakistan, the trouble in Iraq, the trouble in Afghanistan, and the trouble in Israel-Palestine is the mismanagement of the world by the British Empire.
Okay, but we were a part of this.
No, we broke away. 1776.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's right. We were a part of it. In fact, by being the first nation to accept Israel's declaration of independence and by supporting the partition plan under the United Nations. I suppose it's the same way the international community supported the partition plan of India, which resulted in, I believe, something on the order of 10 million deaths. That may be exaggeration. There was huge migration, hundreds of thousands of deaths, or partition plans anyplace else. The problem with partition plans is that if you're an Arab Muslim in Beersheba, and I'm speaking from experience here, of friends, and suddenly you are in a Jewish state, then you are immediately a second-class citizen. It would be the same for anybody else in an Islamic state. And one of our complaints about Saudi Arabia, for instance, that Christians have no rights. Well, the Arabs faced the same thing, and that's why they objected to the establishment of a Jewish state on their real property. And I say that because property rights are extraordinarily important to Americans, particularly those who have found themselves subject to eminent domain proceedings and lost.
Let me throw a little fat in the fire.
Okay.
There's a historical parallel here which we could argue, and that would be the establishment of the Crusader kingdoms on the First, Second, and Third Crusades, late 12th and early 13th century. And we have Israel today, not unlike the Crusader kingdoms. It's almost entirely dependent, like the Crusader kingdoms, on outside help. The Crusader kingdoms of the 12th century were almost totally dependent on what the Vatican and its resources all over Europe were able to send. That's Germany, England, France, and so forth. And when that support dried up, that is, when the Western European states of the 12th century got tired of it, the Crusader kingdom collapsed. The Crusader kingdoms collapsed. And that's what's keeping Israel afloat today, the outside help. Some religionists would say, the Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and the prophets is keeping it afloat. But in point of fact, there is this parallel between this state of Israel today, which is a Jewish island in an Arabic sea, and the earlier Crusader kingdoms of the 12th century. And you ask what the future is of Israel, look to that as an example. As long as there's outside support, where the United States, the American taxpayers, bankrolling Israel, well then, you know, Israel will go on.
Okay. How would Palestinians feel who fled before fighting with their families and had their land taken and then significant legislation enacted afterward that would prohibit them or their children or anybody else from reclaiming that property? So right now you have about 1 million refugees of that conflict living in the Gaza Strip. And sorry to belabor this, but
that's okay.
When you think about there's 1 million refugees in Gaza, along with the descendants of the 500,000 descendants of the original inhabitants of Gaza. 1.5 million people. So when I'm giving presentations, I typically draw a map of the state of Israel and I outline Gaza and the West Bank, and then I superimpose on that an in-scale drawing of the state of Maine. And the entire Gaza Strip, which is home to 1.5 million Palestinian Arabs, fits entirely in Casco Bay, Maine, in the distance and width from Portland, Cape Elizabeth, to Small Point. And all those people have been denied access to reclaim their personal, real property in Israel. So my friends don't complain about the absence of a state for Palestine or the absence of a national heritage or anything else. It really comes down to real property and the grievances that come out of that.
Okay, well, he gave us an awful lot to think about. I'm going to play a little music. As my listeners know, we always try to make the music fit the guests and the theme. So we're going to play some interesting music that my listeners are not particularly used to, but maybe they better get used to it. We're going to play a song called The Holy War.
Oh,
Okay, folks, we're back in the studio. We've had a couple calls while we were off the air. Neither party wanted to go on the air, but that doesn't mean you can't. 593-0013. If you've ever wanted to ask any questions about the Middle East and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, you're never going to get an opportunity like this to talk to two guys that lived it, that wrote about it, are historians, and they're here. So if you want to ask them any questions, don't think that it's a foolish question. There are never foolish questions, perhaps foolish answers, but not foolish questions. Norman, I want to get back to something you said before the break. And you talked about your concern is that apart from all these other considerations, religion, et cetera, that the real problem here is the people losing their land. And, you know, we all know what your land is and what it means to lose your land, no matter how you lose it. What do you see, if anything, is a resolution to this? What's going to happen if and when they split up and say, okay, this is the state of Israel and this is the state of Palestine, and if you're on the Palestinian side, that's fine, but your land that's in Israel or was in Israel is gone. How do you compensate for this? How do you deal with this?
Well, that you've just used the right term. It's going to have to be some form of compensation. And there has never been any compensation to the Palestinians, although the United Nations international donors give them sustenance, that is, help them with humanitarian issues like food and medicine. The problem, you could preface everything in this issue by saying the problem is, and there are about 1,000 of those problems. But the problem is, of course, that over the years we have chastised Israel for its construction of settlements on real property owned and documented in deeds by Palestinians. That property was taken in confiscation proceedings ever since 1967. And there's a whole body of law within Israel that allows confiscation of land. And so what we've done in not chastising them lightly but not doing anything real against that, we have allowed the diminution, the reduction of a potential Palestinian state. Now, when the Obama administration came out and demanded a settlement freeze, I thought, gee, this is really great. The only question – and a positive step. We demand a settlement freeze in compliance with international law and United Nations resolutions, which have declared the colonies, the settlements in the West Bank and formerly in Gaza, to be illegal under all international law. The problem immediate was, though, my second thought was, will the administration be able to make it hold? And my thought was, it's too early in the game for a new administration to take this kind of measure unless they've got their political base shored up. And obviously, that demand for a settlement freeze went by the board by the end of the summer of the same year. So, slowing or stopping settlements is critical, but there needs to be the will of the American people and the administration to do it. And that's very hard to do because about 50 million evangelical Christians believe that the state of Israel should be allowed to grow unimpeded in order to prepare for A, Armageddon, and B, the rapture.
How much of a dimension is that? Are they a powerful group, a powerful lobby?
Yeah, very powerful. They believe in biblical prophecy as interpreted in their way, and that the Bible is the one true story and predictor, God's will, and therefore that you have to facilitate the return of Jews to Israel, the promised land, at which point there will be Armageddon and the forces of good and evil will battle, and the rapture will occur, and those who have not found salvation in Jesus will go straight to hell, and the rest will be saved. So it's a very difficult area to counter because it's based in belief rather than fact or those Palestinian property deeds that those Palestinians held to their property for the entire 400 years of the Ottoman rule.
International law has held that those settlements are illegal.
Okay, but international law has held a lot of things as being illegal, and people simply ignore it. So what's –
Well, but you see, here's the formula. If international law supports your case, you cite it. if international law does not support your case, as in the case of the Israelis, then they don't cite it. It's, you know, it's, it depends on whose ox is being gored.
Exactly.
But those settlements are, I mean, privately, I think every American president, with the exception of George W. Bush, would have told you privately that those settlements are illegal and they're not helpful in the peace process. And they've said that.
They've all said it.
Yeah. Well, then why do we keep funding them?
Well, that's a good question. And I've thought about that. And what I think I see shaping up, and you guys certainly know a heck of a lot more about this than do I, but I almost see the Israelis who have already determined in their minds what land they want and what this division will be. And what they're doing now with these settlements is making de facto, long before the settlement is reached, those lands that are going to be ceded to Israel. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, you're the one who asked us whether we were optimistic, but you were predicting that Israel is going to take whatever land it wants for the state of Israel. How can you be optimistic?
Well, because I think there's going to be a trade-off.
What do the Palestinians get?
They're going to get land.
They're going to get the worst land with no water. Even land that they've gotten already, the Israelis will not give them the water under the land which belongs to the Palestinians because the Israelis want to control the water.
Is that not true? That's the key issue. I think that's going to be the sticking point, is the water, because without water, none of us can live.
You're all right. The settlements, we've always talked since 1967 about facts on the ground. And, right, Israel has a policy that originated in 1967, way under the days of the labor consistent, long-term labor governments. The party considered the peace government. And the settlements have expanded. Unfortunately, their continued expansion is just further encroachment. And when I was in the government, we always were faced with a question from Washington. So at what point do we reach the point of no return where settlements, the breadth and growth of settlements has precluded a peace agreement? And, of course, you could never certifiably send a cable back to Washington saying, we have reached the point, that's it, we can no longer have a two-state solution.
Why?
Well, because you could always claim that with enough international funding, we could buy out the Israelis out of any particular settlement. You're talking trillions of dollars, of course. And so because there was always the answer, trillions of dollars and a will toward peace can always provide an answer, then, frankly, Washington, in consecutive administrations of different parties and multiple Congresses dominated by either Republicans or Democrats, were always able to say, well, then, we don't have to take a hard decision because we're not at the point of no return.
Well, you know, we hear so often about thinking outside the box, and if there ever was a situation that requires thinking outside the box, there's got to be a formula. I don't know what it is. Maybe you guys do. That's what I'm going to be asking you about today. Some kind of a formula that's reasonably fair to both sides. Now, you know, the victor always gets the lion's share.
Why does there have to be a formula? Why does it have to be fair to both sides? Answer my question.
Okay, because I don't think the international community will accept anything less.
The Israelis thumb their noses at the international community because they know they've got the United States backing them up. They've consistently thumbed their noses at the international community. Why does there have to be a formula? Why does there have to be peace? Why does there have to be justice? Well, there isn't a lot of justice. There isn't a lot of peace. There isn't a lot of equality in the world. So tell me why you think this has to be.
I'll tell you why I think. Because there are a lot of people in Israel, as there are in this country, as there are in the Arab lands, that really do want peace.
I don't think so anymore. The Israelis have a very tight little state with those security barriers. They know that if Iran gets out of hand, the United States is going to smash Iran. The Israelis are a regional superpower. They've got 200 nukes. you know, peace. You know, I don't think there has to be peace. Why does there have to be peace?
Why do you say they have 200 nukes? They've never acknowledged having the nuclear capacity. Why did you use that term?
Well, there was a fellow who went to jail down there whose name...
Mordecai Vanunu.
And he was a nuclear scientist down there.
For what country?
For the Israelis. Mordecai Vanunu is an Israeli. He confirmed not only that the Israelis had nukes, but I believe he confirmed those numbers. And these are general intelligence estimates around the world on what the Israelis have. And if you don't think the Israelis have nukes, you're smoking funny stuff.
Yeah. 200 nukes is a lot of nukes.
That'll take care of your enemies. You remember, it's the Armageddon scenario. And if the Iranians come to the point where they threaten Israel, then they'll be used. Or if, look, before the Iraq war, I was in Tel Aviv, and I was talking to the deputy chief of Israeli military intelligence. He said, look, Walt, we can take a lot of things. We can take a chemical biological attack that kills 10,000 people in Haifa, and the Jewish state will survive. We can take, they're not going to hit Jerusalem because that's a mixed Arab Jewish community. But they said the one thing we can't take is a single nuclear hit on Tel Aviv, because if Tel Aviv gets nuked, that's the effective end of the Jewish state. And so...
Now, what did he mean by that? Why did it necessarily have to be the end of the Jewish state?
Well, you just have to know the demography of the place. Yeah. It is the de facto capital until the Jerusalem issue is settled. It's where all the government offices are.
Finance.
Everything, you know.
What if the Arabs get a suitcase nuclear bomb? You know, not something that's going to take out the whole city.
Let's not talk about Arabs. Tell me which Arab country or which Islamic country.
You're right.
And then we'll deal with your question.
What percentage, if you know, of the Arab world is Islamic, if you know?
Like 99.9?
Yeah.
Of the Arab world is Islamic.
Now... Islam is becoming a powerful source on this planet. Do you think that the Islamic community would sit by and watch one of its countries, one of its...
The Islamic community has basically sat by helpless for the last 50 years. They can't do anything against the Israelis because the Israelis have the United States as their principal defender and patron.
Okay, let me ask you this question. It's early on, but let me ask it anyway.
Excuse me, why do you think the Arabs are so mad? They're mad because they're helpless, they're impotent, and they have been for centuries since the collapse of the great Islamic empires of the 14th, 15th century.
Yeah, but things are changing, are they not? Is not the Islamic world getting stronger?
Look, they don't even have decent universities. In top 200 universities in the Arab world, or there isn't one single top university. They don't come up with new ideas. They don't have great institutions of learning. It's still a very backward corner of the world, and its only ace to play is terrorism. Yeah, that's what bin Laden has done so successfully.
Norman, what do you think about all of this?
Well,
I'm getting screwed into this chair more and more. I was 5'6" when I came in here. I'm now 5'2".
Mm. Well, I went to Israel on my second tour in 2002 as chief of the political section as an incrementalist. And I realized that despite the gains that were made in the Oslo Accord, we allowed them to be withered away. And so I think the continued engagement is critical. What I like to do is make sure that people understand the genesis of the conflict so they don't think it's just a bunch of radical Jews and radical Arabs out there killing each other because they hate each other. In fact, there are fundamental real property issues in addition to the statehood issues, the type of state issues, whether you're going to live in a religious Jewish state or a religious Islamic state, and all the baggage that goes with that. So take nationalism, expand it to the 10th power, and we know what nationalism has done in the Balkans and other places, and then lay that on the real property issue and lay that on the religious issue, and you see what you have. But I think it's critical that the United States continue to address the problem because it does serve as the fire underneath the pot that says the United States is against Islam and is determined to use the Arab world and the Muslim world as a source for resources, and that's all. And you can see where some of this is coming from. If you look at the New York Times report, for instance, that we have special operations troops in 85 countries, many of them Islamic countries all through North Africa and others, according to the New York Times. And so there is a real fear out there that the United States is doing something that is not that is to the detriment and wholly and for the wholly selfish purpose of enhancing the wealth of the United States. Now, I'm an American, so I don't have any problem with the idea that we look after ourselves. But I think the longer-term view is that when our actions and our policies make enemies of much of the world, we should pay attention to it. And if, for instance, the leaders of 100 countries, say 100, say the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and U.S. support for Israel in the way it's given is contributing to conflict elsewhere and to anger against the United States, then we need to at least think about that.
Okay. Now, we're getting very close to the first hour, but we're going to continue this discussion into the second hour. We'll go as long as we need to go because I think what's happening here is important. I think the folks out there have never had the opportunity to listen to somebody that's as close to the situation as you are and perhaps might even have some thoughts in terms of resolution. And that's what we're going to be asking you in the second hour, so be thinking about that. Is there any possibility? For example, I want to ask you this now, and you'll answer when we get back on the air. For the sake of discussion, what would happen if we cut our foreign aid to Israel by 50% and said we're doing this because you're not acting in consistent with world peace, and I think this is the only way we're going to stop you guys. If we don't give you the arms and the money to buy arms, then you can't do this stuff. Query, who will Israel turn to? What will the end result to this be? And when we get back for the next hour, I want you guys to tell me about that.